I'm just waiting for the music to start, man. Don't mind me. I'm just the talent. Well, hey, hello, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Oh, hello there. I am Molly Wood.
Oh, hello
I didn't
there.
See you there. Welcome to Make Me Smart. I didn't see you because it's radio. Yeah, yeah. We are joined in your car with you. We're with
or
you in your car.
Wherever you are.
Or wherever you are.
That's the beauty of podcasting, yo.
I've had several friends tell me lately that they went on road trips to Tahoe that involved Make Me Smart binges, which was
delightful. That's pretty cool.
I know. So we're happy to be here with you because, as you know, none of us is as smart as all of us.
We are talking this week to the CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Sue Desmond-Hellman is her name, about how to be smart when you've got $40 billion American dollars that you have to give away.
It is not as easy as you might think. And we are going to wrap up our first deep dive into moral capitalism, which by the time we're back in 2018, may or may not have an official name.
Producer Jenny wrote, will have an official name. And I think that is highly dubious.
We'll call that a solid
highly meeting. Dubious. First, though, a little bit news about us. We are wrapping up the first season of Make Me Smart with a prediction show on December 26th, a New Year's Explain-a-thon on January 3rd. That will be the day that they show up in your feeds. We will have, you know, peek behind the curtain here, pre-recorded them en avance, as they say en français.
À cause de holidays. Our second season, and this is important, will begin in mid-March.
Oh, say that again.
That's right. We're taking a break. Our second season will begin in mid-March. We will have some stuff for you, some little gifts and things. During the break between seasons, we're going to air some of our favorite interviews, our favorite moments from season one. And that is where you come in, as always, because we would like you to tell us which shows you loved the most and you want to listen to again or have your friends listen to. Email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Tell us what your favorite episode is and why.
Also, just, you know, because fair is fair, tell us which ones you hated, and we definitely won't play those. I'm just saying.
That's actually true.
It's really helpful.
Or we
to
might
know.
Just to be needly. Yeah, yeah. But no, you know what? Because one of the things we'll be doing in that break is planning for the second season and what kind of things we loved and what kind of things we don't want to do again. So actually, all of that feedback would be tremendously helpful.
There you go. Now, though, for the last time in this year, 2017, here is our voice of Adam Smith. His name actually is John Buckley. He's a good guy. Here you go.
It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest.
Is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed?
What is free market capitalism?
Is it working for enough people?
It's not working for enough people. That's the bad news. The good news is it can.
They're led by an invisible hand.
You know, financial markets are the first rogue AI.
The stock market is not the economy, and the economy is not the stock market.
I think the next step is to address the assumption that people are rational actors.
No society can be flourishing and happy, of which the far greater part of the members are poor and miserable.
Well, there is hope, but it takes effort.
Is there anything that we can do as individuals to bring about a form of capitalism that works for everyone?
How do you make people care?
You know what we ought to do? We ought to take that apart. We ought to do an annotated version of that thing and explain what it means, why it's there. Anyway, so.
Who all those people are.
There's that too.
It's like a whole show in and of itself.
It's a little encapsulation right there. We spent no small amount of time this year talking about capitalism and whether it is working well enough for enough people. I will say it worked out pretty well for Bill Gates. He's the former CEO of Microsoft, the founder of Microsoft, along with Paul Allen. He also founded the Gates Foundation with his wife and his dad about 17 years ago.
And this is such a fascinating coda to what was unchecked capitalism on the part of Microsoft, so much so that it had to be broken up because they kept
the government.
It was a Simpsons joke. Remember that Simpsons episode where Homer starts an internet company and Bill Gates comes and buys him out? Buy him out, boys.
Have I never told you I don't do the Simpsons?
Oh, my God.
Haven't I told you that?
You know, I try, Kai. You seem like a nice person. I don't understand.
I never did. Never have. Never did. Don't understand the attraction.
These gaps.
Of it. Yep.
All right. Well, somebody's going to post that.
Also,
a link to that
also,
little video
hey,
in your
you kids,
Twitter.
Get off my lawn. Anyway.
And it's going to be hilarious.
Yes.
But so there they were, capitalists unchecked. However, Bill Gates started the Gates Foundation. In 2006, investor Warren Buffett pledged a large portion of his wealth to that foundation, making it the largest privately owned foundation in the world with a $40 billion endowment. They gave away about $4 billion this year.
The question then becomes, how do you give all that money away? And how do you know it works? Because it's not as easy as it sounds.
And how do you know you're not breaking stuff, which is going to be part of this upcoming conversation. The Gates Foundation just released its annual year in review. So while Kai was off in Washington, D.C., being all important, wearing his fancy suit, I talked with the... I like how I assume you just, one.
I do.
I talked with the foundation. Oh, hey, look at you.
Radio. It's radio. I don't have to look nice.
Believe me, dude. Right. Everybody's lucky I have clothes on today just because we had a Christmas
concert
this morning.
That's a whole different kind of radio.
By clothes,
program.
I mean not yoga pants. Just not yoga pants.
About the Gates Foundation.
Kai. In D.C., I talked to the foundation's CEO, Sue Desmond-Hellman. She is impressive. She began her career as an oncologist. She worked on HIV/AIDS treatments. She helped develop cancer drugs. And she became the first female chancellor of the University of California at San Francisco before the Gates Foundation lured her away in 2014. And we actually started out our conversation with, our favorite topic, capitalism. We have been spending a lot of time on our podcast recently asking smart people questions about capitalism as it's being practiced here in the United States and whether it is working for enough people. And it seems like you are a fair person to ask. You're someone who is giving a lot of money on behalf of people for whom capitalism has worked very well. Do you feel like our system of capitalism is working for enough people right now?
It is not. There's no doubt in my mind that what we're experiencing today on inequity, on people feeling like they've been left behind, is a massive issue. And yet I remain a capitalist. I remain very positive about that sense of pace and talent and passion and urgency that I experienced myself when I was in private industry. And I like to think about imagining what's possible. And if you imagine what's possible, if all of what you see when people are just racing and competing and doing the things that people do in capitalism, but applying that to people who are suffering from inequity and making sure that people who have felt powerless feel powerful. That's the opportunity I'm most excited about in terms of how we invest and how we tap into capitalism, but try and help it work for people for whom today it doesn't work.
Well, and talking about sort of whose job it is to solve these problems, we're also at a time, certainly in the U.S., where government is stepping back. Federal government certainly is stepping back. And that does raise the question of who is going to tackle these issues and who will take responsibility for doing them right. Do you feel that now at the foundation more than you maybe did with the previous administration?
We don't pick sides, in elections. So we've navigated in the first 16 years of our foundation, eight of those years were under Bush and eight of those years were under Obama in America. So we can operate in Republican or Democratic administrations. But we do advocate for the role of government in making sure that everyone has an equal opportunity.
Yeah, it's amazing. When you look at the list of priorities that the foundation has, it does look like a list that a government or even a global body might make. What is the tension between a philanthropic organization trying to take on these big problems in parallel or even potentially in opposition to what governments are doing? And how do you navigate that?
It is probably best reflected in our global work. More and more, we're moving from here's what we have to offer when we go to a country or a community or a government, to listening hard about that country's agenda.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking with power comes responsibility. I'm thinking of something like the Peace Corps. There are so many things that seem like a good idea, but you can come in and you can break the way that things were done before. Is there some portion of your staff that is dedicated to, like you said, that listening, that outreach, those conversations? Is that a big part of your philosophy as you go forward?
Yeah, my goal is that every one of the about 1,500 people who work at Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are in that listening mode. And I actually think one of the things we haven't talked about that's the most important thing about what I see at the foundation is the opportunity for us as a foundation to provide innovation and invention. the consequence of the world neglecting diseases, and we even call them neglected tropical diseases because no company is going to work on those diseases, is something that, from a philosophy standpoint, that's what I think about every day. When private industry wouldn't invest in everything from malaria, tuberculosis, HIV, modern family planning that women need. So that innovation piece of what we do, I think, is the opportunity for the foundation to not just be in listening mode on the system change in the delivery side, but to be in invention mode where no one would literally work on it if not for us.
When you look back on the year, what do you see as the foundation's biggest success?
So we are all about eradicating polio. That's been a focus of the foundation, together with many, many partners and collaborators around the world, like Rotary and WHO and UNICEF and many, many others. And as of today, there's been 15 cases of polio in the world. So we are on our way to ending polio. So that's a very big deal. But there's been so many great things happening in the world, preventing diseases like things like measles that you think nobody should suffer today from measles, further decreasing child mortality, mortality that women can experience during childbirth. Like I say, I don't want to give you a laundry list, but there are so many of the aspects of what Gates Foundation was that helps people and families survive and thrive.
Yeah, super interesting conversation. I should say here, it's clear that in a lot of ways, Sue Desmond-Hellmann was brought into Gates, I think, to pivot that foundation in a more medical direction. Obviously, Bill Gates has talked about malaria for a long time and that trying to eradicate disease is not a brand new thing for them. But as you will hear in part two of our conversation, it's a little bit of a shift to that way more specifically in terms of Gates, although they put out a year-end review that also talks about foreign aid for U.S. education applicants and a really strong call for gender equality. So they're doing kind of all sorts of different things like family planning. But I think in part two, you're going to hear about the thing that you've probably heard most about the Gates Foundation.
Well, let's hit that. Let's do a little music and then we'll hit that second bit.
All right. This takes a little bit of backstory and is part of the reason I think you heard Sue Desmond-Hellmann talk about listening. The Gates Foundation has been involved in education since it was founded in 2000. The results, to say the least, have been mixed. I think there's a lot of frustration sometimes in the teaching and administration community about their efforts. One thing you need to know is that we talk about Common Core in this part. That is actually in reference to the Common Core State Standards Initiative, which was an attempt to standardize what K through 12 students should know in English, language arts, and mathematics by the end of each school year. The Gates Foundation was a huge proponent of Common Core and came in with the kind of very somewhat understandable techie guy perspective that data matters and that there should be standards and that that works with computers and user interfaces and that that would help improve education. So they put a lot of money behind Common Core and behind influencing the U.S. education system. Last year, the foundation admitted that it had struggled to make systemic change. The exact line was, quote, "It is really tough to create more great public schools," to which I and I think a lot of teachers basically said, yeah. So here's our conversation about education. I live in Oakland, so I have a child in public school, so I'm feeling the real struggle. This year, you write, our education efforts are evolving. Can you talk about the foundation's history with education?
Yeah, the foundation's been in education, as you know, since the beginning. And Melinda often says that of all the issues we work on, education is the most challenging. And that is absolutely the case. The history of our efforts in education and the public discourse around education is, and if you live in Oakland and access the public schools, you know what I'm talking about. This is something where if we and we do, believe in an equity agenda. We believe education should be and must be, public education must be there for everyone in America. And so our efforts in education, we have focused a lot on teachers. We've focused a lot on schools. We've looked at school size during the evolution of our education strategy. And just most recently, the pendulum is swinging back to more local and state control of education. And that has to do with the Every Student Succeeds Act. And we are acting accordingly.
How much of this is a story of unintended consequences, though? The efforts that the foundation has made in education have profoundly changed education in some parts of this country. Common Core was a big push, and it was adopted across the country. Teachers were fired or reallocated based on these programs. You know, the Gates Foundation has the money to have a major impact. All along, you know, if teachers and administrators were saying that the foundation wasn't listening to their concerns and advice and input, what are the lessons that you learn from that topic of education about how to wield the foundation's power and resource?
The one thing that I want to talk about a little bit is this, the standards, the Common Core. What we learned is that teachers needed more support and more curriculum support, more time, and teachers needed more support to implement that. And that was a really important learning that our foundation had. And today, as we look at things like Common Core, we see pockets where we're seeing those standards being used and things getting better. But in no way would anyone declare victory. And I think that's been a really important thing. Teacher accountability, as you mentioned, how that's done and how that feels, again, going back to the school level and the community level, is a really important thing. So we think that we're increasingly, and this is true in health and in education, understanding the impact and the role of place in how we think about education.
To what extent then, you know, again, given the size of the resource and the potential for influence, to what extent do you consider it sort of your problem to solve versus those local school districts or government?
I don't consider education or any of the things that we work on our problem to solve. I consider the resources of the foundation and the role of the foundation is to be partners. Our resources, however large they are tiny, 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 tiny in comparison to government funds. And that will always be true. And so we should be complementary and we should be responsive to the community's needs. And so I think it's our obligation to listen, to adjust, to course correct, and be driven by what is needed by communities to provide public education.
Well, so that's fascinating. And you heard her give a beat before she gave you that last answer, right? And granted, it's mm-hmm. not her problem. It's not the Gates Foundation problem to solve. None of these are. But the fact is that governments across the world right now are pulling back from a lot of these things, whether for fiscal reasons of their own, political reasons of their own, what have you. And mm-hmm. the funding and support that come from places like the Gates Foundation, but also others, is instrumental. And I think it's interesting that it took her a minute to go, well, let me see how I'm going to phrase this. Anyway, you know.
Well, yeah. It's interesting, like where I grew up, you know, there were a couple things you were suspicious of, and one of those things was do-gooders, because such a thing as unintended consequences. Yeah. And so the Gates Foundation was very certain of its positions on education, and until it wasn't, right? Yep. And after it wasn't, it had already helped implement Common Core across the country. Like, the entire country is operating on an educational model that was heavily pushed and funded by this foundation that's now like, oh, that was hard. So yeah. I'm not saying governments always get it right either, but I think it just becomes this really interesting question of who should be in charge and what it means to have enough money to have that much influence.
Right.
It's almost like a corollary to the capitalism conversation.
Yeah, actually, it kind of is. We've got a link to the whole Gates Foundation Year in Review document on our website, makemesmart.org.
And, of course, this will not surprise you. We asked Sue Desmond-Hellman our Make Me Smart question.
Something I thought I knew.
That's a really tough question.
That's a big old hunker of a question.
Gosh, that is good.
You know, it's the end of 17, New Year's resolutions. I spent December 31st, 2016 in a hospital bed, having just broken my hip in a slow speed fall from my bike. So what I learned, as my mom told me, is, in fact, I'm not indestructible. You know, we've been talking about the world and the role of the Gates Foundation. I think the world is more resilient, just like me. I'm ready for ski season now. I think we're all more resilient than we thought.
Wow, slow speed fall from your bike, man. That's the worst. If I'm going to fall from my bike, I want to do it at 40 miles an hour. Just saying.
I want it to happen fast, get knocked out, and not even know.
Always wear a helmet.
Totally.
Always wear a helmet. More from you coming up. First, though, got to pay the bills, as always.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
The end of the year is coming up fast, you know, and that means time is running out to make your tax-deductible donation to Support Marketplace.
We are all about making people smarter about the financial forces that govern our lives through solid reporting, hopefully interesting stories, and the kind of conversation that we have on programs like this one.
It's important work, and we're doing it already, but with your help, we will do even more of it.
Yes, this is a great opportunity to be part of our efforts to raise the economic intelligence across the country and make a real impact in people's lives.
Now is the time, yo. Go to marketplace.org and make a gift in any amount to become a Marketplace investor. And thanks. All right, so we're taking a quick break next year, as we mentioned, coming back in March with a new name for what we started out calling moral capitalism. We are, as yet, I think, betwixt the two of us, three of us, if you include producer Jenny, or like, you know, five of us, if you include like the hires up and, you know, all those people who get a vote on what comes out of our mouths on this
So
program.
Many invisible votes, everyone.
One last time, though, this year, we're going to ask for your vote. Head over to makemesmart.org and vote on what you think we ought to call this concept of moral capitalism or what have you.
Yeah, we haven't even narrowed down the choices yet because we've gotten so many, but we will have some options: balanced, conscientious, inclusive, equitable, blah, blah, blah. on
blah,
to
blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah, blah, blah, will be a choice, by the way, because
totally
why not?
Will.
2 weeks ago on this program, we interviewed Raj Chetty about his study on the people he calls the Lost Einsteins. It was a very thought-provoking conversation. So if you missed it, go check it out and tell your friends. Start there.
Yeah, a lot of people did check it out, and we got a mail. We got mail from many of them. Let us just say that.
Where do we mail a letter?
In the mailbox.
In the mailbox. Jason Spellmeyer went to the mailbox. He is a grain farmer in Ohio.
I have to say the most innovative people I've known have been machinists and mechanics and, yeah, crusty old farmers. Some of those folks I might even describe as Einsteins. But I don't think any of them are lost. In fact, I'm pretty sure most of them are right where they want to be. So yeah, statistics might show that there aren't as many patents coming out of rural America as Silicon Valley. But maybe that's because folks here are busy making the next thing they need to get the job done.
Boom.
Ooh, really interesting. Yeah. You know, that's funny because the Gates Foundation Year in Review document talks about how relying on data to address the problem of gender equality is flawed because data itself is sexist. So maybe the measurement of the Lost Einstein study was flawed. Too.
Yeah.
Good to know. Josh Warner had this to say.
My name is Josh, and I lead a development team for a large semiconductor company in Silicon Valley, but I grew up without much money in a poor part of Phoenix. I didn't have a male engineer influence in my life, but but I did have a grandmother who started out on a factory line, one of Motorola's Phoenix fabs. Without a college degree, she worked her way out of the fab and retired an executive. She bought me my first computer, and the semiconductor industry was a pervasive part of our lives growing up. I've never considered just how much exposure to the industry through my grandmother influenced my path as an adult. Love the pod, guys. Thanks.
Josh doesn't screw around, man. He does what he thinks straight up. How about that?
He does, and I like it.
No joke. Robert Waltz, St. Paul, Minnesota. Here you go.
I found your conversation about lost Einsteins very worthwhile. I'd have found it even more worthwhile if it hadn't been for the strong sense of deja vu, because I've been there before. Oh, I'm not an Einstein, and I've been fairly advantaged. As it is, I'm merely underemployed and my talents wasted. You see, I have autism, and I'm 56 years old, so no one knew what autism was when I was young. I had to figure it out myself at age 49. I don't want to compare my situation to someone at the bottom of society, but there are many roadblocks facing people. Balanced capitalism needs more than fairness for all. It also needs to find a way to accept people with other goals and other ways of thinking.
Didn't see that one coming.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting and fantastic. And then we got one more from Rebecca Eklund.
Hey, Kai and Molly. This is Rebecca from Baltimore. And I was listening last week when your guest, Raj Chetty, was talking about how humans today, particularly, he said, I think in the U.S., live better, richer, and longer lives. And the longer part is certainly indisputable. But the better and the richer claims gave me pause. I wonder if it is true that we are living better and richer lives than people did in the past. I was just wondering what you thought of that.
So Raj Chetty is an economist, and when he says better and richer, he actually means richer and better, as in more money, right? The catch is you get more money, you get more problems. Because better and richer in straight capitalist terms does not mean better richer in moral or spiritual terms. That's what I got.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that that is it is really interesting how essentially almost all of these comments were in some form, you know, just taking issue with the premise, which is what is better? What is more productive? What is an Einstein? Which I love. I love that. That is so thoughtful. So thoughtful. See, we are smarter together.
I don't get any credit for more money, more problems. What?
you do.
Okay.
You
do. All right. Good.
Yep.
Man.
Good job.
Killing myself over here.
That was a great joint you put together.
I believe this is where the music is supposed to come up, actually.
Can you save us from ourselves right now?
Come on. I'm looking at Jenny and she's going, no, I'm not bringing it up.
She's like, no,
okay,
I'm going to drag it out.
Here it comes. Oh, my God. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Emily Henderson, and also the senior producer, Nancy Bargalli. This week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe, who was a hair late on the music cue there, if I say so myself.
Oh,
our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday. What? He's sitting right there. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed the music.
Someone's getting a lump of coal in the old marketplace stocking. The executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
Have you seen the marketplace socks, by the way? There are marketplace socks.
There are. Yes.
There are. There are marketplace socks.
If you just ignore that kind of vaguely horrifying photo of the bottom of Kai's foot, they're pretty cool.
It's not like I said, please come take a picture of my feet. It's like the development person came to me and said, hey, can we take a picture of you wearing these socks?
A lot of feet.
And I said, sure, I will do anything for Marketplace. And she said, great, take off your shoes.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.